Alltag in der IT-Zentrale.
PCs mit KI können die User-Produktivität steigern und Cyberangriffe schon im Vorfeld erkennen.
Tada! KI rettet Firmen-PCs.
Jetzt mit Leistungsboostern.
KI für Firmen-PCs mit Intel Core Ultra-Prozessoren und Intel vPro. Ergebnisse können variieren. Mehr auf intel.de/itheroes.
Tonight we're gonna party like it's 2006 with the very first episode of Retronauts. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Retronauts. Did you enjoy our exciting new theme created by Bob, why don't you tell them about the theme?
That theme was created by the amazing band Anamanaguchi.
They did it just for us.
Yes.
With the money that you, the people, gave us. We gave it to them,
so
and they
like
gave
it.
Us music. Anyway, hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hi there.
Let's go around the table to introduce ourselves, and then we can talk about this thing. We can talk about what we're going to talk about, and then
exactly.
We can talk.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, hi, my name is Jeremy Parrish. I am this episode's host for Retronauts,
yes. But
that's only a temporary designation. It's a roundtable sort of thing this time around. And to my right, which means nothing to you because you're not listening in stereo.
This is Dr. Sparkle of Crontendo, and I'm the guest star today, apparently.
The special guest star.
Yes. And I'm Ray Barnholtz. Hi, everybody. It's good to be back.
And I am Bob Mackey, and you should know who I am. So
should we say something about that roundtable stuff a little bit more?
The roundtable stuff.
Yeah, because maybe
I mean, let's talk
expecting.
About Retronauts.
Yeah, I think we need some sort of like preface to this.
Long ago, in a distant land known as Ziff Davis.
Oh wait, are we allowed to say that? Or do we
sure, why not?
Bleep that
it's
out.
It's part
maybe.
Of the history.
Okay,
you can't bleep history, man. You can't censor history. It's written by the winners, and we won, maybe. Actually, no. So we started this podcast, Retronauts, in 2006, and I thought it was going to be a fun little whim, and then it turned out to be this thing that went for like 100 episodes and then some, and then I got tired of it because of situations, and then Bob took over.
Hi, everybody.
And Bob kept it going well, until Ziff Davis came back after 1UP.com was shuffled around to different owners, and they came back, and within a month said, we got rid of 1UP once. Let's make sure it's final this time. And so the Retronauts podcast went with it. So we decided to, you know, keep the spirit going and also the name, but not the content. We don't own the content. All the old stuff that happened, and it's still at 1UP, and you can read it and listen to it there. But this is basically a clean break funded by, again, you guys through Kickstarter.
Right.
People were very, very generous. What was the final tally on Kickstarter? It doesn't
like
matter. It was a lot of money.
$7,000.
We wanted enough to, you know, buy some equipment and record some podcasts.
Right.
And you guys gave us enough money to do way more than that. Do videos and books and I don't know what else. There's just a ton of stuff that's going to happen. Yeah, I mean, we're going to do the summer shooting carnival.
I'm building a water slide.
And anyway, so this is our first episode of 26 that we're committed to. They'll go up bi-weekly, and in between each episode, there'll be a mini episode on the off weeks. And so that's a total of, 52 episodes total of varying size. And, you know, if we can keep going, you know, find more funding for a second, third, fourth year, who knows? We'll just see how this goes. We're not committing to anything yet besides what we've already committed to.
Right.
But
so
I'm excited. I'm hoping it keeps going.
The thing about the roundtable stuff is that the three of us, the founders of this new Retronauts, will each host their own episode, alternating weeks. So,
right, no one person is running the show. We're all co-bosses or whatever. So each of us is going to take turns hosting the show and the mini episodes, and even doing the videos. And we're each going to kind of bring our own unique interests and approaches to the show. So it'll be very different from week to week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll be especially true on the off weeks because we're going to use those episodes to do things a little more off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So hopefully everyone enjoys it. It'll be a chance for us to kind of all do our own thing. Unfortunately, my thing is probably going to be pretty much what I did from 2006 to 2011 because I'm really unimaginative.
Would not have it any other way.
Yeah. Also, should we mention like, this won't be on iTunes now if you're downloading it, but it eventually will be, so stay tuned.
Add it manually.
Yeah.
Do that in iTunes.
Oh, yeah, Ray.
Click in the advanced menu and click on subscribe to podcasts. You can put in the URL It goes in the same as usual. It's like you actually did go through the iTunes store and add it.
How about that? Yeah, I'm not really clear on how all that's going to work, but at some point we'll be on iTunes and
yeah, soon.
I think we have a SoundCloud subscription.
Yeah, Retronauts on SoundCloud. Yeah. We'll put the episode there too.
And of course, our home base is retronauts.com. So anything you need and want, you can find there.
So this is sort of like a real life professional podcast then.
It pretty much is. I mean, not professional in the sense that we're making a living off of it, but in the sense that it's funded and we actually have a plan in place.
Professional quality.
I hope so. My God, that's kind of the dream here.
Yes.
That's kind of the ambition. We'll see if we can actually
opening day jitters or opening day malfunctions. We'll fix whatever we need to fix.
Now that we've got the first pitch out, I'm okay.
Yeah.
It was the whole setup process, but we got our machines working in, actually a lot faster than we were ever able to get the podcast setup at IGN working.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good.
Lean and mean.
Ray.
So yes. And, we're here in this kind of, shared, building office
space. We need
space.
To talk about where we're recording.
And if you hear people singing in the background, it's because we didn't realize when we rented this place out that apparently there's a group that meets here some days and does like yoga singing or something.
I knew that because I read it on the website.
Did you?
Yeah, it was actually scheduled on the website. I was a little surprised when that was scheduled the same time as this, but...
Well, how
we'll
about
to,
that?
Work around yoga chanting in the future.
Yeah, I mean, there's a nice Dulcim reference in there somewhere, but that's about it.
Yeah,
or ask for donations for our musical episode.
It'll be the Cop Rock of podcasts.
Yes,
oh, I don't want that to happen.
Oh, come on, it'll be so good. Okay, it'll be like the Buffy singing episode.
That's
of
how
podcasts.
Things get canceled.
Anyway, so without further ado, why don't we roll on into Retro?
Yeah.
Here we are in this brave new era of Retronauts. I wanted to call the show Retronauts Advance, but Ray was having none of it.
It's Wait,
my
did you,
fault.
Did you have another name, Ray, in mind, or just want to keep it?
I like the True Blue Retronauts. You
I
know?
See.
Not actually.
These colors don't
it,
run.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So I guess it's Retronauts Volume 3, because Volume 1 was my episodes 1 through 99, and Volume 2 is Bob's episodes, which went up to what, like 50?
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. I think I did 50.
Almost 60-ish, yeah. Or just because this is kind of a reboot, we can call it like Ultimate Retronauts.
Yeah. Or Retronauts Zero.
Yeah,
we can I already did Retronauts Prime. That lasted two episodes.
Retronauts Alpha 3 Dash.
We can all be minorities instead of, you know.
What?
What?
I'm just trying to think of Ultimate Spider-Man and stuff.
Oh, oh right, okay.
I was going to say, in the future world, we white people will be minorities. That's very exciting, actually.
But okay. One thing hasn't changed, and that's we complain about Virtual Console liberty.
No.
Wait.
This is a brave new era.
That's true.
And as if to prove it, Nintendo has backed us up by giving us two really strong weeks of Virtual Console. It's like being back in 2006 again. It's crazy. Yeah.
It's as if they knew we were going to record this week.
Right.
No, there have been a ton of great games on Virtual Console. And not only that, but Retronauts was kind of defined from beginning to end in the old days. With lamentations about Earthbound, and after Retronauts went off the air, Nintendo said, "Yeah, okay, fine. We'll give you Earthbound on Virtual Console."
Except they said, "We noticed recently people have wanted Earthbound, really? Not for the past 10 years.
We
or anything.
Finally logged on to the internet and discovered that people have an interest in this game called Earthbound."
Yeah. I think Iwata just never checked his email in like 13 years.
I think it's more like those Retronauts punks are finally off the grid.
So at some point, are we actually going to get Mother 3 in the U.S.? Is that?
Let's not get crazy.
Okay,
that's another battle. I think
Clyde Mandolin, aka Tomato, who translated the game for the fan translation, has offered to give his translated script to Nintendo to use, but there's a. Not much chance of that actually happening. There have been some third-party publishers who have used fan translations. I think Exceed used a fan translation of an East game
For they did.
Oath and Fel'Ghana, didn't they?
I think it was 1 and 2 Eternal or something like that,
okay.
Maybe? I don't know.
Chronicles, maybe?
It was an East game.
Yeah, anyway, so that's not outside the realm of possibility, but I can't imagine Nintendo ever letting that happen because it would give legitimacy to something that they ignore. To Nintendo's credit, they do ignore that kind of thing. Like, Wow.
Yeah.
Project AMR2, another Metroid AM2R.
Oh, that's still
happening? Another Metroid 2 remake. Yeah, the guy's still updating about it.
Good.
There's a dude who's been remaking Metroid 2 for years and years, and they've never put out a CND.
They're not like Square with that whole Chrono Trigger remake.
Right. Square puts the kibosh on things, but Nintendo, like, I know that they're aware of these things because I've talked to people at Nintendo about stuff like this. And their attitude is pretty much like, we're willing to let it slide as long as no one's making money off of it. As soon as someone decides to make money off of it, such as trying to get funding, you know, like trying to take the advertising revenue cut on YouTube videos based on Nintendo games, that's when they come down. But as long as people are just doing things out of their, you know, out of love, out of fandom,
right.
You know, like, what's that new Super Mario Brothers Wii hack? That's like super crazy. Newer Super Mario Brothers Wii?
There's several now, but yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's all these mods and ROM hacks and fan translations, and they're okay with that. It's when people try to make money off of things that they have an issue. So
it's if you put them on a little bootleg controller and sell it at a mall kiosk, then maybe that's...
Yeah, exactly. So, So you know, Nintendo kind of has this line in the sand that they're okay with. But at the same time, I don't think they're going to acknowledge, like, oh, hey, thanks for translating this game for us and encouraging people to download the ROM of it and play it without our permission.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they didn't put the kibosh on the Mother 3 fan translation. So they kind of walk a line, like, you know, we'll look the other way as long as you don't...
We'll look the other way, but we won't actually give people what they want.
Yes, because that would be too easy.
Yeah. And profitable.
And profitable.
Right. Well, there's money to be made on new sequels, I suppose.
So are there what were the games released recently on Virtual Console? I know Mega Man 2 through 4 came out like in one day on 3D or on Wii U.
Yeah.
Mega Man 6 came out on 3DS.
Right. And don't forget Spelunker.
Spelunker. Wii U. How could I forget Spelunker?
Yeah, of course.
What, you mean the original Spelunker?
The NES version.
Yeah, the NES.
I'm surprised that wasn't released a long time ago, because that was that released earlier in Japan or something?
It was released on Wii a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
But this is Wii U is like a whole other beast. The way they're doing Wii U Virtual Console releases is you can bring all your Wii content over to Wii U and play it through the Wii emulator shell.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want Miiverse support and off-screen gamepad play, then you have to get the Wii U release of it and wait for that version to be released. And if you own the Wii game and you've transferred your account over, then it costs like $1, $1.50 to get the bells and whistles. So it's pretty reasonable, I think. But if you haven't bought them, then you have to buy them fresh.
I mean, I guess I'm just not familiar with these fancy new consoles like you kids have today.
The now all of Nintendo's systems have two screens. It's crazy.
There was those. And yeah, I mean, it's nice because now that Mega Man is a Smash Brother, it's like, oh, now we can finally release the rest of those Mega Man on there. So there we go.
Oh, now Nintendo kids care about Mega Man.
Yeah, that was their E3 present.
Yep.
I'd say it was more of a stocking stuffer.
Yeah, pretty much.
So yeah, what else is coming out on Virtual Console or has come out of note? I mean, Super Metroid, all the 30-cent games are out now.
Yeah, no, not all of them. Yoshi just came out.
Yeah.
And I think there's like two more that are coming out.
I don't think, does anyone actually want Yoshi though? Because no. I noticed that was...
It's worth 30 cents.
Okay. Yeah. I never liked it.
No.
It feels...
It's not a real puzzle game, really. It's just kind of like, it's dumping stuff on you and you just have to take care of it. It doesn't have like a real hook to it.
There's no combos or anything, right?
Yeah.
It's not that advanced.
Like, at least Yoshi's Cookie, you can, you know, match three, there you go.
Yeah.
And you can control that differently. But Yoshi is just like, oh, let's take care of these Goombas and Bubbles, I guess, and then try and make Yoshis out of them.
They're just giving you a biology lesson on how Yoshis are born.
Not one of Game Freak's better games.
Oh, it's Game Freak, that's right. Yeah.
Oh. So, Dr. Sparkle, I'm sure that we're really building up your enthusiasm to get around to Yoshi when it comes up in Crontendo. Actually, why don't you talk a little bit about Crontendo?
Yeah.
Because it's relevant to why you're here.
Yes.
Well, I suppose so. Crontendo is something I've been working on since 2007, but it was sort of underground for a couple years before anyone actually found out about it. It's a simple concept, just taking every single Famicom or Nintendo Entertainment System game and playing them in chronological order. And it's trying to be based on the original release date. So Japanese release dates, or if it's a US-only game. But the problem, of course, is that we often don't really know exactly when most U.S. games were released.
Yeah. Japanese companies are really good about chronicling the exact release date of their games, but it was a lot slipperier in America.
Yeah, Nintendo, their website at one point had this PDF file of every U.S. Nintendo Entertainment System release by the month. But the dates, I guess, just no one knows what those dates are.
Well, distribution was slippery here. I remember.
Fell off a ship is when it hit the store, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, games would, you know, be estimated to come out at a certain date, but it was really just kind of whenever the stores got them in stock. The game industry was not the machine that it is now, where everything has a very specific release date. You know, midnight of Tuesday morning, there you go, your new game's out. It was much, much looser, and, you know, video games were pretty much categorized under toys back then, so toy stock still works the same way, actually, aside from, like, big launches, you know, around a Star Wars movie or, you know, an Avengers movie or something. Toys just kind of come into stock, and the stock boys put them out as they have shelf space, and that's pretty much how it worked with games.
Yeah.
I guess younger folks today might not be aware of that, but often you found out about new games just by going into the toy store and seeing them on the shelf. I mean, there wasn't all this pre-release hoopla where, oh yeah, people are going to be lining up, you know, at 6 a.m. in their little, dressed up in their little outfits to buy the first copy.
Sailor outfits and stuff.
I do remember also different stores had different games, which seems completely bizarre today. Like, you go into one store and you'll see completely different games, and you go to, you know, Toys R Us would have some different games in Sears, then different games in your local video store and everything like that.
I hated that.
At least in my neck of the woods, that's what happened.
And back then, I mean, you bought things just based on the cover.
Yeah.
I mean, you knew nothing about the game.
Or the back of the cover. Oh, yeah. Back art.
Well, yeah. And even sometimes that was a little bit on the deceptive side.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So again, yeah, the U.S. release dates are a little tricky to nail down. But anyway, you seem to have done a pretty good job with it.
Yeah, you have to sort of like do things like look through old magazines, find advertisements, that sort of thing, look through issues of Nintendo Power.
Do you find that websites for developers will list all of their old titles and, you know, when they came out? Like, if you went to, like, Kemco's website, do they have, like, a list of their history? I know some do. I don't know if you use them as or not.
Probably not many. I mean, obviously there's a lot of online resources, people who have done a lot of research as to these old games. But a lot of video game companies are not real fond of documenting their history.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Like Irem's website, I think, did like some kind of like huge wipe like a year ago of just tons of content.
Oh, well, that's because of what happened to Irem, which was the whole company got a wipe of a huge amount of content. So that just kind of follows in the footsteps of what was happening there as they refocused on Pachinko. Alas.
But yeah, I know what you mean, because it's just like it's bullet points now, because so many of those older game companies are all just like holding companies and completely different entities, and it's just like a bullet point on their investor relations page. It's just like, yeah, this happened. Cool, huh?
This 20-year thing happened.
But hey, check out our iPhone games.
And as a rule, I mean, Japanese companies' websites are often kind of terrible anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, trying to navigate them, they're often kind of unprofessional looking despite being these huge companies, and trying to sort of go through them and find information is not always the best way to go about things. But I think probably just what we know about a lot of old video games is just based on fans doing research.
Right.
Yeah, the Japanese internet pretty much built around cell phones. Hmm. And not smartphones, but like really simple cell phones. So a lot of their websites have never evolved beyond something that will look very readable on a small mobile screen, even though, you know, Japan has gotten into smartphones in a big way. It's kind of slow to catch up on the design side, the tech side.
Yeah, so we think of them as a sort of like this high tech country, but in a lot of ways
they still use fax machines a lot.
Yeah. Well, I know about that. I have to work with fax machines on a daily basis. Believe it or not, U.S. companies do it too.
All right.
So the thing with Crontendo is right now, I guess I'm about sort of halfway through the Nintendo's lifespan, 1989.
Are you just doing NES? Because with Cron Sega and Cron Turbo, Cron Sega, I guess, you've gone from Master System onto Genesis.
Well, yeah, I sort of had to, because, I mean, the Genesis was a lot more interesting than the Master System in a lot of ways. And it just seemed foolish to not sort of fold in the Genesis games into that particular series. Are you asking, like, if at some point I'm going to do, like, Super Nintendo or something?
Yeah, or Game Boy. Game Boy is looming if you're in 1989.
Well, no, I've already covered the launch of the Game Boy. Mm-hmm. And in one episode, we actually did a sort of rundown of, very quick rundown of all the Game Boy games released in the first year.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So, but no, there's never going to be a Kron Game Boy. I mean, Game Boy games are cool, but I think visually they would be boring for people to look at on a video because they're monochrome, small.
Fair enough.
I do like how you've had to say something new about a golf game every time you encounter it. God. Although I don't know if you've even stopped doing that.
The golf games, I mean, they just never stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they all look identical, except for maybe a few.
Well, yeah, they all have that exact same system of, you know, pressing the button once to bring your golf club back and pressing it again to bring it forward. And, I mean, the differences are very minute. It's kind of like all the Japanese baseball games as well.
Yeah. Good old sports games.
So, anyway, was that part of a bigger topic, or were we just asking you to talk about Crontendo?
I think that was sort of like the guest star introduction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Make so we can plug. Move on to the show itself.
Wow.
Did we want to talk about the two classic revivals that just happened this week in Japan?
I mean, you are the one who spent money on it, so I need to justify that
right.
in some way.
So, okay. So let's get our negativity out of the way. This week in Japan, well, I guess by the time this episode comes out, it was 2 weeks ago. But yeah, there were two games released for 3DS that revived classic franchises. One was, I don't even know the full title, but it's a sequel to Jaleco's Jaja Maru-kun games.
Really?
And the second was the first Umihara Kawase sequel since, like, actual sequel since 1998 or 97. It's been a long time, so 15 years for this Super Famicom kind of cult classic finally got an update, and it's mostly a sequel. It's kind of a remake because that's kind of what they do, but it's much more new content than anything since Umihara Kawase Shun in 97 or 98 anyway. Yeah, so the thing about the Jaja Maru-kun game is that it really sucks. It's like absolutely terrible.
So it's true to the spirit of the original games.
It is some of the worst platforming I've ever had the displeasure of playing. It baffles me because at this point, the platform genre is, you know, 30 years old. If you want to say it started in earnest with Donkey Kong, that was more than 30 years ago. Like, at this point, everyone should know... just kind of the baseline. How do you make a good platformer? Well, you make it so the jumping controls are pretty precise and your character does what you want when they jump. But they skip that part on the new Jaja Maru game.
So is it like aimed at sort of like the Japanese nostalgia market? Like, remember all those crappy games you played when you were a kid?
I don't think deliberately so.
Well,
I think it's
short
just
answer,
bad.
Yes. Yeah.
I think they're going for the nostalgia. Like, hey, kids, you played Jaja Maru-kun when you were a kid. Here's a game in that same spirit, but then it just turned out to be probably worse than they intended.
Was the PS3 Spelunker as bad as the original?
No.
The remake? Or did they actually make it into a playable game?
It is. Spelunker HD is great. Yeah.
But in Japan, I mean, they've always loved Spelunker, right? I mean, even though it's horrible, they still love the game.
That was one of the first games to come out for Famicom. So it was in that period where... third-party games to come out. So it was in that period where the system was really exploding. We're going to talk about this later, but... there were still only like 24 games for it. So every game sold really well and every kid had like all the games and, you know, they cost a lot of money, you know, it was like $60. So, yeah.
And that was the exact same thing that happened in the US as well. When that first sort of wave of games started, people like were buying all those horrible games from LGN and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Cause it's like the Nintendo boom days.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Everything's going to sell at profit.
And yes, there is you know, there's nostalgia for Friday the 13th. There's NECA is selling this crazy San Diego Comic-Con exclusive this year that is a Jason Voorhees, and the packaging is designed to resemble, like, it's got all this art from LJN's Friday the 13th video game for NES. And the colors of Jason himself like the same as the sprite. He's kind of purplish and light blue. It's very strange, but you know, I think it's the same kind of thing. Mark McDonald, formerly of EGM and 1UP, now of 8.4 localization, he loves LJN's Jaws game, and I don't know why, but he thinks that game is amazing.
That game was developed by Atlas or someone like that.
Was it?
Friday the 13th was too.
Yeah, all those LGN games were actually subcontracted out somehow to Atlas, and they actually subcontracted some of them out to other companies.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, share the blame.
Yeah, but they're all Japanese companies though.
Right. I thought a lot of LGN stuff was Rare too. Or am I thinking
that was more Acclaim?
Acclaim, yeah.
Yeah, Rare was back then like the only Western developer actually making games for the NES for a while.
They put out like 5 games a month for years.
Yeah, it was Rare or nothing.
Yeah.
We're kind of just talking about our topic now.
Yeah.
So maybe we should just skip talking about Umihara Kawase. You're a girl with a fish hook and you swing around and it's really hard and now you can be 3 different girls.
And the UI is in a weird place. Wait, is it still in a weird place? The UI?
It's just, it looks like clip art.
Okay.
The crazy thing about the 3DS game is
I think
that
Bob means the score display.
Oh. Yeah, it's like in the screen is big, but it's in the center.
It's not quite as janky this time.
Okay, but, that was always weird.
But I do like that for the 3DS game, they've taken the really weird looking just like scans of like photographs and pencils and things like that. It was all very surreal. And they've taken those things and then very faithfully converted them into 3D polygon graphics. So there's no new aesthetic to it. It's like the same thing, but with kind of low resolution polygons or low budget polygons. It's kind of weird, but, you know, still the same basic game, which means it's, you know, soul destroyingly difficult.
Sweet. Yeah, I have the collection on DS, and yeah, that's to me, that's all I need, because it's just like the original 16-bit version and then like the PlayStation versions.
Yeah, no, that DS game is pretty much, I'd say, the definitive release.
Yeah.
It plays really well. It's not like the PSP port that was really busted and kind of weird. And like, it takes care of the slowdown that was in the Famicom version or the Super Famicom version and has both the Super Famicom and PlayStation games. So it's pretty much complete. The new one is a little different, and I don't like it quite as much, but it's still nice to see the game has some life kicking around. And I know apparently it's being shopped around for a US release, so maybe that game will finally, after all these years, come to America.
Yeah.
Who actually published that game?
Well, originally it was published by TNN, which means Think of Needs of Notice for Human Beings.
Oh.
It's the best publisher name ever.
Yeah.
And I think the PlayStation version was published by Xing.
Hmm.
Or Zing, or however you want to pronounce it. And the new one is developed by Agatsuma, who did Code of Princess last year. And I think it's self-published in Japan. I'd have to check. I don't have the retail release. It's, you know, I got it from the eShop, so I don't have all that stuff kind of in my face. But I'm not sure who's doing the publishing, but anyway. That's Umihara Kawase, or sayonara Umihara Kawase.
What? She's going away?
Maybe.
Oh, man.
Could be. This could be the grand farewell tour. Umihara? Or it could be like Phil Collins' first farewell tour.
Oh.
Where he went around and, yeah, whatever.
Funny more farewell tour. Farewell tour.
Okay. So this week, I wanted to talk about, because we're launching Retronauts, I wanted to look back 30 years to July 1983 to talk about the simultaneous launch of 3 different major, well, kind of major, Japanese video game platforms, the Nintendo Famicom, the Sega SG-1000, and the MSX Computer Standard. All of those debuted on or very close to July 15th, 1983, and all of them together kind of cumulatively marked the, really, for all intents and purposes, the birth of the Japanese home gaming market. Now, you know, PC games had been around in Japan, and there were lots of standards, kind of like we had, you know, the VIC-20 and the Tandy and whatever else here. And there were a few Japanese consoles before that, the Epic, what the hell was that called?
The Epoch Super Cassette?
Yes.
Cassette Vision?
Right. But nothing that really caught on. Nothing really found any traction. American systems had been imported. The Intellivision particularly was released, but it was incredibly expensive. The Atari 2600 had been sort of unofficially imported, and the official release of it came actually after the Famicom launch. So the Japanese home market was in kind of a chaos, basically. There wasn't really any single leader, and it had never had sort of the traction that Atari found in the US market. Like, people liked playing video games at home, but they just didn't have a single standard or even a competition like we did in America between Atari and Intellivision, ColecoVision.
Yeah, it was kind of like those doldrums of just like the super blocky Pong clone type machines, or just like rudimentary racing games and stuff like that, which, you know, in Japan, I mean, because we'd seen those a lot in the West as well. So it was just kind of like aping those and that, trying to recapture that sort of.
Yeah, and Japan was clearly, they were clearly into video games. I mean, everyone knows the story about Space Invaders and the yen shortage or whatever, supposedly, that happened. And, you know, Nintendo had a pretty big hit for itself with the Game & Watch handheld systems that it started making in 1981. And, of course, Japan was doing gangbusters in the arcade. They created games like Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, Space Invaders, Galaga, Pole Position. Yeah. So, like, there were lots of really, Dig Dug, you know, the list goes on. I would say that their games actually probably fared better than most American developed arcade games.
Right.
But for some reason, that just never quite translated into a home market.
Well, I think the big problem is that they weren't being licensed out for the Japanese home stuff. You know, it was all like clones. It wasn't Pac-Man. It was Puck Monster or whatever.
No, that's true. The Cassette Vision never really had its own official games.
Yeah.
To speak of.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's the story until later, until what we start to talk about.
So I don't know. Do you guys have anything to add to that?
What time period are we in now?
So let's up to July 1983.
Okay. Did we talk about Nintendo's history with consoles before the Famicom? I mean, just the TV, various TV games that they produced.
Right. That's what I was thinking of when I mentioned those. Yeah. Like, they all had sort of those humble beginnings like that. I mean, Nintendo was probably one of the first to actually try that and then move on to, you know, dominate the industry.
Right.
I don't think there were any Sega ones like that, necessarily.
Now, from what I understand, I mean, Japanese toy companies and electronics companies tended to be pretty conservative. And I think something like Atari really required someone with a huge visionary plan and someone to take huge risks to actually put that thing on the market. Maybe just Japanese companies at that time didn't want to go into those uncharted waters.
Yeah, I think also there is that. And Ray, like you said, you know, the lack of licensing. Japanese companies were licensing their arcade games to Atari and to Coleco. I mean, there was a huge deal with Nintendo and Coleco over Donkey Kong and the rights with the Atari computer version and so on and so forth. But yeah, I mean, when Nintendo entered the market with the Famicom and Sega entered the market with the SG-1000, they both kind of took different approaches. Nintendo was really focusing on their own creations. I mean, they had three really strong arcade titles by that point, Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., and Popeye. So that was what they launched with. And then Mario Brothers came out shortly after in the arcades, shortly after the Famicom's launch. Actually, I think it was the same day as the Famicom's launch. Right around the same time. So that made it to Famicom pretty quickly thereafter. Sega, on the other hand, didn't have any like blowout hits. It didn't have anything that was a success, a licensing smash on the level of on the level of Donkey Kong. They had, you know, published or distributed Frogger for Konami in some regions. Yeah. But, you know, their games were good, but none of them were quite breakthroughs. Like,
now, when was Zaxxon in the arcade?
Zaxxon was 1982.
Because that seemed like a pretty huge game at the time.
You know, I didn't see Zaxxon around a lot. I saw it a couple of places, and everyone was really fascinated by it, but I never really saw anyone playing it either. And I think it's because it was so advanced for the time.
Like, it was amazing.
The isometric graphics and the flight-accurate control stick system, which just completely baffled me as a kid. I did not understand that game in the arcade. I wasted like a dollar's worth of quarters just crashing into the wall, and I thought the system was broken.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I got it.
I do that now like in the game.
It wasn't until I got the ColecoVision version that I finally realized, oh, it has like this crazy backwards control system. And then I got it and it was fine. But yeah, Zaxxon looked really great. And actually was apparently coded and developed by the same people who did Donkey Kong for Nintendo. But I don't think it was just like a huge epic smash. And in any case, it didn't show up on the SG-1000 for a while, if at all.
Yeah, but it seems like back then, at least, I don't know, around here, it seems like I saw it quite a bit in arcades. But again, they had nothing sort of that like huge level of Donkey Kong where they were making like Donkey Kong toys, Donkey Kong cereal. There was nothing like that for Sega.
They had Congo Bongo, which was exactly like Donkey Kong. It
involved an ape.
Right. It was their very blatant attempt to be like, well, Donkey Kong's for Nintendo. We should try that too. Uh-huh. And I was familiar with the game, but it was never a cultural phenomenon. It never had a serial or a Saturday morning cartoon like Donkey Kong did. But what Sega did instead was license a lot of games. I mean, they kind of did what, addressed the issue that Ray was discussing, and they licensed in games, and they took the Atari approach, which was to do the programming on those games themselves. Mm-hmm. So you had things like Sega Galaga, and that was actually what it was called, was Sega Galaga, because they programmed it themselves. Mm-hmm. And actually, the work they did with third-party titles that they licensed in, personally, I think it turned out a lot better than most of their first-party stuff. Mm. Like the SG-1000 versions of Congo Bongo, of Flicky, of Wonder Boy, like those games are not very good. No. But Galaga is actually pretty decent. I mean, their take on Galaga is, the SG-1000 was comparable in power, very, very comparable in power to the ColecoVision. It was pretty much the same architecture. But I thought a lot of their conversions of other people's games look better than the ColecoVision versions. So there's that going for them.
Should we talk about the, I guess, technical limitations of the SG-1000? Because it is shockingly primitive if you're not expecting, what it has to offer. I think there's no scrolling, right?
It has scrolling, but it doesn't have smooth scrolling.
Okay. Like,
they could force the system to scroll, but it was very choppy.
I've only seen, you get to the edge of the screen, all of a sudden, bam, the next screen is there.
Yeah, they did that for Wonder Boy, and it's a really bad idea. But it could do some scrolling. I mean, if you look at Flicky or Girls Garden, which was Yuji Naka's first game, they do have some scrolling, but it's not smooth like it was on Famicom.
Right.
And actually, smooth scrolling was a big technical advance for that period. You saw it in a few arcade games, Defender, Moonranger, a few others, they kind of sold themselves in the fact that, yes, we can do more than one screen. And the Famicom was actually able to do that right out of the box. If you look at games like Wrecking Crew and there's a few others in kind of the early era, Ice Climber.
Now, Wrecking Crew starts with like a beautiful pan of the level vertically.
Yeah, they're pretty much just like, look at this thing we can do. Oh my God, we figured it out. But even at the beginning, not all of Nintendo's Famicom games had scrolling.
Most of them didn't. The first one to actually have any kind of scrolling at all, I believe, was Hogan's Alley. Mm-hmm. You scrolled across like a panorama of the cityscape where like the guys pop out with the guns and shoot you.
Yeah, and I don't think that was really a technical limitation. I think it was just a design limitation. It was like they weren't thinking in terms of multiple screen vistas. Yeah.
But it's odd that that was one of the system's major strengths. Yet they didn't really start off on that foot. It took a while before they actually started putting scrolling into the games.
I think Famicom was Nintendo learning a lot of things. Those first 2 years of Famicom before it came to the US, if you look at that period, it's basically Nintendo kind of getting its sea legs and figuring out what the hell to do. Because at the beginning, when they first started letting third parties make games for their system, there were six licensors originally, I think, Hudson and Tecmo and Namco, and I can't remember who else.
Hudson and Namco were the first two.
Right.
And a few more came on board afterwards. I think, Tecmo was an early one.
Right. Actually, Hudson ported Tecmo's Star Force. Right. So I guess Tecmo didn't initially publish. But anyway, I was just reading through David Sheff's Game Over yesterday to kind of confirm some of these facts. And yeah, there were six licensees. And then after a certain point, Nintendo realized, well, we're not really having any control over this or making any money. So they reworked their like their licensing terms and said, we will make all the games. You pay us money, you give us the code, we will manufacture the games and give them to you. And that caused a lot of heartache with Namco. If you look, if you're ever in a Japanese game, used game shop, like the Namco games for Famicom are all they're all boxed and shelved separately because they all came in these plastic clamshells. Like Namco took, I think, a lot of pride in the games that they made for Famicom.
Weren't they also numbered?
They were. Namco? Yep, yeah. Yep.
A few companies did that.
Yeah, quite a few publishers. Taito did that. Hudson made as well.
Hudson did for like the TurboGrafx. I mean, PC Engine. They did. I know that. They all had basically their own special like cataloging system as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was like a real collector's mentality, I think, to those early games. They sort of like, you sort of wanted to like buy every single
one series
and put them numbered on your shelf.
Call them volumes. Order.
Yes.
Yeah, but Namco kind of had like this, you know, they enjoyed their special terms of having been one of the early licensors or licensees, and they weren't really happy about the change in terms, which is why you had Namco games showing up in the U.S. from Tengen rather than from Namco themselves until like 1993 or so when they published their own Ms. Pac-Man finally, or Pac-Man. Right. I can't remember.
I want to say like Taxan, whatever the hell that was, published a Namco game like Mappy Land.
Yeah. There were a few licensed.
I don't even know what Taxan is actually. I just know it was real.
Yeah, every single Namco game got just sent out to just random publishers, it seems.
Yeah, Bandai did Dig Dug.
Okay. Yeah, and Xevious.
Mm-hmm. And I think Galaga also.
Yeah.
But yeah, then there was kind of like the cutoff point, I think, where things fell apart in Japan, and then all of a sudden Namco games started showing up as Tengen games as sort of a, hey, suck it, Nintendo.
Well, of course, I mean, Tengen and Namco had very close ties, because the guy running Tengen was from Namco, and Namco, I think, owned a chunk of Tengen for a little while.
And, well, yeah. Tengen was also an offshoot of Atari to some degree. So,
Atari Games, the arcade division, which was owned by Namco.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so it's all kind of weird and whatever. But in any case...
there's like a Godfather-style chart on our wall here.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, we should invest in pushpins.
So in any case, the sort of the narrative there is that Nintendo kind of got its bearings in those early years, and like if you look at the run-up of NES game design, Super Mario Brothers is pretty much the point at which Nintendo arrived. Like, it took them 2 years, but they finally got it. They finally made a game perfectly suited to their console's strengths, something that was, you know, on par with anything you could have played in the arcade. Really, really deep, really, really well designed. Just a joy to play. And, you know, obviously that became the system seller. But it took them a while to get to that point. But fortunately, in Japan, they didn't have a lot of really, really strong direct competition. I mean, Sega had the SG-1000, and you could put the two systems side by side, and you could see a clear difference in the technology between the two. Even when Nintendo wasn't doing scrolling games, when it was just single-screen games, there was more color, the sprites had better definition, the music was better, the controller was much, much better. I don't know if you guys have ever used an SG-1000 controller.
I can imagine.
I don't know what it looks like. Does it have a cross pad? Or?
No. It's basically kind of like, it's not quite a square, but it's very reminiscent of old PC control sticks, where it has like a very, very skinny metal stick.
Right.
And like, I think one button, I can't remember, one or two buttons. But it's not fun to play.
Very much the predecessor of the Master System's controller.
Yeah, really, I mean, most systems had kind of bad controllers back then. Like, the 5200 was pretty notorious, as I recall.
Yeah.
I mean, the 2600 was good for what it was, but you only needed one button on that thing.
Right.
Yeah.
If you wanted to play Robotron, then you got two controllers.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, the paddles and all those sort of things as well. And then the Intellivision had a pretty weird controller.
Yeah, it was similar to the ColecoVisions, where they had the numeric keypad at the bottom.
But that Famicom controller was basically sort of the starting point for modern video game controllers.
You know? Right.
They're all sort of just sort of building on top of that, just putting on more buttons, little sticks, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they actually use the control pad design on Game & Watch first?
Yeah, they took the Game & Watch cross pad.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember which came first. Yeah,
that came first. And
it felt like the move away from joysticks was an attempt to redefine the experience, too, because it's like the joystick is now the arcade thing, and this new pad is now the home thing. I mean, it took a while for that to happen.
Well, joysticks work in the arcade because they're anchored.
Right.
But on the home systems, you have to hold a joystick, right, and or else get like a really heavy one that's weighted and set it on the floor.
And with suction cups.
Right, yeah. And that it just doesn't work as well. I think Nintendo had a big breakthrough with that. And, you know, by creating something that you could hold comfortably in your hands and not have to sort of create leverage for, you just held it. One thumb went over the D-pad, one thumb went over the buttons. That was all you really needed.
I think the other extreme of that is that Coleco Super Controller or whatever it is. Like a giant...
It's like the big triangle?
Yeah, no, it's like a huge hand grip with like a stick on top of it. And then also...
No, I mean, once
like a mitt.
Once the NES came out in the US, I mean, third-party companies, I think also what the Nintendo Advantage as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all... Ever since, we've always had these third-party joystick controllers because people like them better for certain games.
Right. And they do work better for certain games, but, you know, for the things that Nintendo was creating, that kind of basic platformer action game, the D-pad worked really well. You needed quick responses and, you know, not having to hold down the controller to be able to give yourself a little bit of an anchor for your leverage. Mm-hmm. It was a really good controller design, even though it was originally on the Famicom, built into the machine and not removable.
And do they have a patent on the cross pad design that no one else can use it, or is that since gone away? Because at E3 I previewed some cell phone controller and it actually had the cross pad. I'm thinking,
the Dreamcast had it.
Patent couldn't still be good nowadays.
Right, patent life is what, like 20 years, 25?
It's not real long.
I just know people had to avoid patent that design.
Patent hasn't been destroyed like copyright has.
Yeah.
Patent is not an indefinite thing because they didn't patent into
Mickey Mouse. Though it has its own problems, obviously.
Sure,
right.
Yeah, we can get into intellectual property laws. But,
episode 2, patents.
But that's pretty much what all the video game discussion is these days, IP.
But you are right, Bob. There are more of that popping up.
Yeah.
There is more.
So anyway, those were the two consoles that that launched in 1983. And then sort of as their counterpart, there was the MSX computer, which was, it was a computer, but it was an inexpensive computer and it was a hybrid computer. It had a cartridge slot in it, kind of like the Texas Instruments 99-4A.
Can we say what MSX stands for? I forget.
I don't know. I've heard different things.
Like not Microsoft something, right?
We talked about this on Old Retronauts.
We did.
Very recently, I believe the creator of the platform said it was machines for software extendability or something like that. So,
Most people thought it meant Microsoft Extended or something like that. But in any case, it's a three-letter acronym. Yeah. It's a three-letter acronym and it's catchy. It has an X in it, so it's cool.
Is it actually pronounced MS Cross?
No.
Not that I've ever heard.
No.
It should have been.
Yeah. You're right. Nice and Japanese that way.
I mean, there was a pretty huge home computer market sort of starting to build up at that time. Mm-hmm. There was like the FM7.
There was the Fujitsu FM7, the Sharp X1, and the NEC PC8801. And all of those systems went on to have descendants. Like those kind of platforms, their families lasted more than a decade each. Mm-hmm. And actually the MSX continued to truck on into the 90s with the MSX2, and there was the MSX2 Plus.
And then Turbo R.
Yes, that one also.
But the PC-88, that was basically like the Commodore 64 of the Japanese game world. I mean, there so many games came out for that thing.
Right, yeah, and NEC did really end up dominating the industry. I mean, as much as they had tons of competition, but their PC 88, 98 stuff was pretty much like the nexus.
the thing is, though, the NEC PCs were still pretty expensive. The MSX's big advantage was that it was much less expensive than other...
Probably more comparable systems to the Commodore in that sense.
Right. But it also had a hardware architecture that was very, very similar to the ColecoVision. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like the PC version of the SG-1000 in a sense. Although, actually, Sega ended up making the SG-1000's follow-up was a PC add-on, kind of Coleco Atom style.
Was that the SG-2000?
I don't think it was the 2000. I can't remember what it was 3000? Called. Was it? Yeah, their numbering system's weird. Yeah. There's like three systems and then the Mark III, but whatever.
Right.
Sega. They were a little confused about the whole home market. It took them a while to kind of settle down and get things sorted out.
Like the seed of the MSX hardware was like the Spectravision, which was a slightly obscure console, which had very similar hardware that was sort of co-opted for the MSX, but
Right.
And
Yeah, I feel like it's really hard to find good comprehensive historical perspectives on the MSX. Right. But from you know, just looking at release lists and how many variant systems were made of it, because it was a standard, it was kind of like right. the 3DO. It wasn't a console released by a company. It was, you know, like the IBM PC architecture. It was a standard, and so people were able to license into that and... I don't even know that they had to license into it. It was just they could make their systems according to that spec, and everyone could be assured that if you bought one of these machines, then the games that you bought for the MSX standard would run on that machine regardless of what kind of, you know, what company made the machine for you.
Yeah, something like that.
And it had some success in Europe as well.
It did.
I believe.
Yeah, emphasis on some.
Yeah.
not nearly to the degree that it did in Japan, but...
And yeah, I guess it was sold here, but you had to be deep in the Radio Shack to even find it.
No, I don't really think so.
I think it had a very, like, super, super limited release.
Oh, yeah, probably.
And never really went anywhere.
Yeah.
So you're not going to find MSX software in America.
Sort of like the Timex Sinclair.
Yeah. And technologically, again, one of the big problems with the MSX was the lack of good scrolling. It could scroll, but in a very sort of... Herky janky, jerky. Yeah. It looked absolutely horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And as a result, you know, the MSX had longer legs than the SG-1000. I think because of its ubiquity and just kind of its accessibilities for manufacturers, and the fact that it wasn't just a game machine, it was also a computer, so you could do kind of basic computing on it. Because of that, it did have a longer life. And as home console design, game design, began to expand and become more ambitious, a lot of developers started to sort of, you know, approach the sort of mature content, you know, mature not in the sense of like M-rated, but more developed, more refined, more expansive content that you started to see on Famicom and, you know, to the C64 and other big platforms like that, within the confines of the MSX. So you had games like, you know, Castlevania, Akumajo Dracula came out on Famicom in 1986. And about the same time, there was an MSX version under the same title that had a lot of the same assets, a lot of the same, you know, play mechanics and weapons and goals and enemies and all of that. But it still played very differently because it was all like you moved from screen to screen. And instead of being just kind of a linear battle through each level, it became this sort of almost like a labyrinth with like the level design looped around and kind of an infinite loop.
Which sounds like a lot of MSX games, too, especially from Konami.
Yeah, no, labyrinth Konami games. kind of had a little, they kind of cornered the market on that particular style of game for whatever reason. And, you know, that has a certain nostalgic cachet to certain people. And so you have games like La Mulana that are very clearly made in the style of Konami's MSX1 games. You know, La Mulana scrolls, but like its essence is very, very similar to that of Konami's MSX games. And a lot of publishers, Japanese publishers, put their games on MSX simultaneously with the Famicom version, or they would take a Famicom game and release it for MSX. Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy both had MSX ports. I think they might have been for MSX2, which was a more advanced standard.
Yeah.
More colors, smooth scrolling. It's the system where Metal Gear showed up. But yeah. You know, as you know from Metal Gear, like the system was still pretty limited in a lot of ways. So designers still had to kind of work within those constraints. And, you know, sometimes it did create really cool things like Metal Gear, where they said, you know, let's figure out what we can do that's different within the limitations of this machine instead of just creating sort of a watered down action game that doesn't quite look as good as what you'd see on NES.
Mm-hmm. So is this where adventure games really took off in Japan? Or was it, you know, the microcomputers?
Well, they really happened more on the microcomputers.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, the PC-88 was probably the platform, and also the 98 as well.
I mean, is that where Snatcher started as a PC-88 or 98 game, I think?
Yeah. It came out on a bunch of platforms, but I think the 88 may have been the first.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think the Portopia serial murder case by Yuji Horii was the first Japanese graphical adventure, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I mean, there were other ones before that, but it was a pretty... It was a very popular one. NX was actually releasing tons and tons of games for the PC-88 at that time.
Some of them very racy.
Oh, yeah. Some of them you don't really want to play today. But, there were, I mean, I know one of the very first ones was actually a port of the Sierra game.
Mystery House.
Mystery House, yes.
Oh, yeah.
With much better graphics. The Japanese version has much better graphics for some reason.
Yeah, they redrew everything.
Yeah, like in the original Sierra version, everything is just a crude cartoon character. But in the Japanese version, there's some weird sense of style to it. It's not just like, look, we made graphics, but it's like, look, we can make good graphics.
Artistic license.
Well, yeah, the Sierra game was basically an amateur production. I mean, it was just more or less done by a couple people, I believe.
Just like displaying graphics on the screen was in itself an achievement. So,
yeah. And but, so, yeah, a lot of classic franchises that people think may have started on MSX or Famicom. A lot of them did start on the other platforms and then were either ported to MSX later or just released multi-platform, you know, around the same time. So like East and Snatch and things like that.
Which came out on everything.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Falcom, the creators of East, are interesting because they were very much a computer-oriented company. Like the 8801 was their jam. But, you know, they also recognize that, oh, the Famicom boom is really huge. So they, like, would contract out these kind of weird spinoffs, like Dragon Slayer 4, which became Legacy of the Wizard. And then there's Fazanadu, which means Famicom Xanadu. Like, that was developed, I think, by Hudson.
Yeah.
So they were kind of like, let's dip our toe in the market. But, you know, they never really went entirely over to consoles. They've always been maybe more now. They kind of lean on the PSP, PS Vita.
Yeah.
But up until, you know, like 5 years ago, they were still very much a PC-oriented company.
Which may have actually been a pretty good strategy. I mean, they're still around, unlike a lot of those old computer game companies.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so much shakeout. Like, you look at a list of developers and publishers for the Famicom, and you'll see some names you recognize, obviously. Like the big ones, Konami and Capcom, but the people who made smaller companies like Meldak or whatever, like
VicTokai, but they're still around. But they just don't do video games
anymore. Yeah, VicTokai actually survived up until the Saturn era, I think.
Hmm. I mean, a lot of those companies were not entertainment companies or video game companies. They were like companies who saw there's a lot of money being made.
Right.
Like book publishers got into it.
Right. Pony Canyon, which was a music distributor,
and record labels. Mm-hmm. Those kind of people, I mean, of course, they usually did not have internal development divisions. They just wanted some cash.
And also, usually, their games were the really bad ones.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you know?
Whereas, you know, companies like Capcom and Konami that had their kind of arcade roots tended, not always, but tended to make better games for Famicom and MSX. Actually, did Capcom ever publish on MSX? I don't know that I've ever seen.
No.
That seems kind of weird.
Yeah. Huh. They definitely did for the other computers.
Konami was
licensed to.
Yeah. Konami was really big into the MSX.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were probably the most prolific, you know, recognizable name for the MSX. But it's kind of strange. Like, everyone published on Famicom, but some people were really into the MSX and some people not so much.
Yeah. A lot of the MSX developers were like definitely smaller software houses. And some of them went on to like the consoles, Wolf Team. Those guys started as computer developers and they just went on to consoles after that. I guess computers didn't work out for them. So yeah, they moved on to like, you know, the Mega Drive and whatnot.
Yeah, there was sort of like a slow transition for a lot of companies from the computers onto the consoles. Like, well, Square and Enix, for example, would be, you know, went on to quite a bit of success in the consoles, but they all started on the computers and just sort of slowly transitioned away from it.
Yeah. That definitely all happened the most in the 90s because, like, I don't know why exactly. I think it was just different standards approaching and also just, like, continued dominance of, like, NEC. And, you know, so you had, like, the market sort of shifting and shaking some people out. And they decided, oh, I guess the money's better on consoles because then at least we can probably make the games we want to as well. and then everybody else is making... all the other computer guys are making porno games. So there you go.
Well, yeah, eventually Japanese computers became almost entirely like visual novels, adult games, all that stuff. And that's, from what I understand, mostly what it is today.
Yeah, it is. It was always a constant, and now it's just like almost it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is really strange that, you know, PC game development has become such a huge thing in the West. I mean, it was never small, but... with the advent of 3D graphic accelerators, especially, like, that just became sort of a baseline for really big budget, hardcore game design. And Japan, like, has never had that. I don't know if it is because of, like what Ray said, because of Hudson's dominance or NEC's dominance. Mm-hmm. Sorry. It's weird. I don't have any answers. Yeah.
And then later, like, everybody moving on to, like, Windows 95 and stuff like that. And then finally things become a little bit more globalized in that sense. Like, that just changed sort of the game market over there for PCs.
Yeah, so July 1983.
Yes. Yes.
I would love to go back and actually like be at ground zero of all these console launches just to get a take on what people thought of them at the time. I mean, obviously we know what became of the Famicom and what became of Nintendo after that, but I don't feel like it was a given that, you know, Nintendo was just going to become this console powerhouse, that they were going to dominate the market so greatly.
Well, maybe it wasn't a given, but I'm pretty sure that was their plan. I mean, I think they actually did have really big plans for the system. And I from what I understand, they actually put a lot of money into advertising it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they calculated the launch of the NES or the Famicom really, really carefully. I mean,
and then the NES.
And then the NES, yeah. But yeah, I mean, the success of the system was not an accident by any means. But at the same time, it had a lot of it had a lot to overcome. You know, it did have fewer games at launch than the SG-1000. I think the SG-1000 had about 24 games in its first year, and Nintendo's Famicom had about a dozen. You can compare the quality of those games and say, well, the Famicoms were better. But, you know, it's kind of a... I guess Nintendo still plays that game. Like, we don't make as many games, but look how good they are. So, you know, there's kind of a precedent for that, I guess.
Yeah, it's odd. I mean, Nintendo actually debuts each new console in Japan with relatively few launch games. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the N64 had 3 games in Japan at launch. Same thing with the GameCube.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Sega never really dipped their... I mean, they dipped their toe into the console market, but they never threw themselves completely into it until later, the way Nintendo did. Because Nintendo virtually stopped making arcade games once they put out the Famicom.
Right.
Whereas Sega had their arcade division, they had their home division. They never completely turned themselves over to the console.
Yeah, I think after Donkey Kong 3, Nintendo published one more arcade game in 1984, which was arm wrestling.
The arm wrestling game, yes.
And I think that was it. I think after that, they just said, you know what, let's just go all in. There's more money to be made on console games, especially, I think that's around the same time that they said, wait a minute, we're going to be the ones to manufacture everything, and everyone's going to pay us up front, and there's going to be no risk for us. It's all going to be on the publisher's backs.
And I mean, the arcade fad was slowing down by that time, too.
Although game centers in Japan have had a much stronger, more durable life than arcades in America. But yeah, I mean, you know, they didn't have control over that market. I guess, Hiroshi Yamauchi's Yakuza connections weren't as strong as some other people's connections. I mean, the arcade industry over there is, it's about as shady as it is here, or maybe even shadier. I don't know.
Is it shady around here nowadays?
Maybe not so much anymore, but in the 80s, I know, and before that, like, arcades were...
Well, they were considered to be kind of like places where lowlives hung out.
Yeah, but I know there were supposedly a lot of problems with distribution and, you know, lots of rackets going on there.
A lot of back scratching.
Yeah.
That was the golden... Well, maybe not the golden age of the mob, but... The mob had a presence.
They did. And you know, that might have been...
Golden Age of arcades.
Yeah.
That might have been more prevalent on the East Coast than in California, too. I can't really speak for that because I didn't live in California, and also I'm not involved with organized crime. But...
Well, at least you don't admit
it. Not that I'm going to talk about anyway.
That's the new Retronauts. Fun and on kick there.
Yeah, we're going to be going for a long time. Nintendo definitely went all in on consoles at that point.
And Sega invested a lot of energy in making all those high-tech arcade games.
Right, and their arcade games were so good.
Yeah, like in the arcade, they were basically just constantly competing with Namco.
Yeah.
They were doing the same sort of thing.
Right. I mean, they were pretty much the Nintendo of the arcades. Mm-hmm. They were to arcades what Nintendo was to home consoles. Maybe not quite, but But definitely, like, they were pushing the limitations. They had, you know, things like the superscalar technology, and you know, in the 90s they had their various 3D model boards push so many polygons. Yeah. What the hell is the name of those things?
What?
The power, I don't know. They're arcade boards in the
Virtua Fighter. Model 1, Model 2.
So complicated. Yeah. Why can't I remember
that? Okay.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, they were always really riding that cutting edge, and they seem to be a very technology-oriented company, a very like tech innovation-oriented company. And I could see where that mentality wouldn't sit well with consoles, because consoles are more or less static technology once you create them. I mean, Nintendo and Sega both did kind of dabble, well, Nintendo more so, in the you know, onboard cartridge chips that would extend the abilities of their consoles. Kind of an early version of Microsoft's Xbox One Cloud, if you will. But you know, that also added a lot of expense to their games, and so you ended up at the end of the Sega Genesis era with games like Virtua Racing and Phantasy Star 4 that cost $100 straight away. Like, it's, you know, the something had to give at some point. So
yeah,
you're right. I mean, Sega never really embraced the console market the way that Nintendo did. So I can see where that kind of undercut them. But then again, you know, maybe they never embraced the arcade or the home market because they had so much trouble competing with Nintendo, and they never quite saw the same success with their home consoles that Nintendo did, at least not until the Genesis.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's really sort of like a chicken versus the egg kind of thing. But either way, I mean, Sega definitely put their money into the arcade division. The consoles were always sort of going to be the ugly red-headed stepchildren for Sega.
And always Sega's problem has been, you know, different branches not communicating or working with each other. So that could have been another example of that. Like, we need more money for this, but we want money for arcade, you know, games too.
And, you know, Sega, until the Genesis era, they never let go of that Atari-style licensing approach, where they would license other people's content and then program it themselves. Games like R-Type, you know, up into to the 90s, they were making the games that they licensed. Mm. They were not, as far as I know, I've certainly never read anything about them, like, secretly subcontracting stuff out.
Well, they used, like, related companies like Bits, for example. But as I recall, the Master System only had two games in Japan that were not published
by Sega. And
they were both
by Tecmo.
Well, there were Tecmo games by some weird company that no one's ever heard of who only put out those two games that may or may not be related to Tecmo. But it was all first-party stuff on the Master System.
Yeah, pretty
or
much.
Or third-party licensed stuff published under a first-party label.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, they were definitely slow to embrace the things that made Nintendo so successful with the Famicom, that's for sure.
And that really sort of changed when it came to the Genesis. I mean, that was Sega's big thing, right, was getting EA on board for the Genesis, and that sort of when it all took off for them.
Yeah,
pretty much. Well, you know, Nintendo kind of did that to themselves because their licensing terms were so draconian and placed so much burden on publishers. So many publishers, you know, they had to buy a minimum order of, like, 10,000 units, I think, and they had to pay for it all up front, and then they had to do the distribution on it. And if those games didn't all sell out, then they, you know, they'd already paid for them, so they lost money and had to do the fire sale thing. If they did sell out really quickly, then there was like a 6-week turnaround period for a new order to come in, by which point the heat may have worn away on their games. So it was it wasn't really a publisher-friendly approach that Nintendo took. And that's something they didn't let go of until, what, like the GameCube era?
Till like Wii U, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that's still...
Because you heard the horror stories about like old WiiWare publishers. Like,
oh, yeah, that's
apparently
true.
Apparently they
wouldn't
pay people until it sold a certain amount of copies.
Right, so, yeah. I think that's what happened to La Mulana, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Like, it never came out on WiiWare just because by the time that it was... Well, okay, but it didn't come out from the intended publisher because the intended publisher said, well, there's no way we're going to make money on this because of all the delays it's been facing. Yep.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah, after a few years of that, I think people were ready to jump ship to another platform when Sega came knocking and said, hey, we like you, and we're going to work with you, and we're going to make it easy on you.
And then, funnily enough, the same thing happened a few years later when Sony came along, and everyone jumped ship from Sega to Sony.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. It's just an endless cycle of people not learning from each other. And the same thing happened a few years later when Sony did the PlayStation 3.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Funny how things work.
It's all circular.
Yes, indeed. Much so like anyway, this podcast.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about 1983. Is there anything else that needs to be discussed?
Well, I could sit here talking about MSX all day, but
why don't you? Well, I mean, that's something that we don't really we don't know a lot about. Or do you want to do an MSX episode?
I might.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything relevant to 1983?
Not really. Boy, those MSX One games were really bad.
Some of them were okay.
Yeah. Well, too rudimentary. I mean, once you finally got to MSX Two, like then everything had more colors and
right.
Finally looked good on a screen by screen basis, at least. So yeah, that was like their heyday, was the MSX 2, which was like late 80s, not 83.
But yeah, it is interesting that you know, totally, I think by coincidence, Nintendo and Sega and, you know, MSX were all sort of arriving in Japan and really kicking off the market over there right around the time that the American console market was imploding. I mean, it had really it had taken a heavy blow in the fall of 1982 with you know, Warner's massive debt or, you know, their profit shortfall because of Atari and just the mismanagement that happened there. But, you know, over the next couple of years, the American home console market just disappeared. It dried up,
right?
And retailers were really eager to wash their hands of the whole thing. They put all their video games into a bin where you could fish through them and buy anything for a dollar. And once those were gone, they were like, we're done. So Nintendo had a kind of an uphill battle to fight. But, you know, it left a huge opportunity for them because all the big American companies either dried up and disappeared or just, you know, were really, really cautious. Like Atari had another console in the wings, the 7800, and decided to hold on to it for years, because the market just wasn't there for it, for them to launch a new console. So, you know, it gave Nintendo and to a lesser degree Sega this chance to really kind of get their footing in Japan. And after a couple of years of that, then they made their move into America, and the market there had recovered enough that some retailers were interested in giving it another shot. But American companies weren't really in a position to be the one to make the overtures. So, I don't know. It's just an interesting turn of history, turn of events.
Yeah.
Well, it's just a matter of being in the right place at the right time, I suppose.
It is, but it's one of those instances of right time, right place that has had ramifications that lasted decades. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because Nintendo remains a big powerhouse in the industry.
Yeah, sometimes it's the right people, too.
Yeah, and, you know, Sega had a good run for almost 20 years of making consoles. So, yeah, I mean that one summer like launched a lot of different things that had a big impact on the video games that we played and loved, and, you know, people our age who grew up playing NES are the ones making video games now. So the kind of influence of that era has really started to bleed through into the things we play. And, you know, I'm not just talking about Retro City Rampage. I mean, like just the overall sensibilities and just kind of the design philosophy of a lot of those games. I think you see it in other games we play.
Yeah, caring more about like feel.
Yes.
Not so much graphics.
And that is happening more kind of in the indie space, because I don't think you're allowed to make games about feelings if you're putting more than, say, $10 million into it. But
yes.
But yeah, but there's definitely a sort of a movement, I think, over the past few years to sort of get back to the essence of those classic games that Japanese developers were making back in the 80s and early 90s, and not just in a visual sense, but, you know, the sort of intangible spiritual sense as well.
Right.
But of course, let's not forget, I mean, that back then the majority of the games were pretty terrible. I mean, we sort of cherry pick examples in our minds of, oh yeah, you know, Metal Gear and all these games from Nintendo and whatnot. But I mean, there were just literally hundreds of absolute junk titles dumped on the market constantly.
Yeah, I mean, that's Sturgeon's Law, and that was true before Nintendo, and that's been true in recent years as well. I mean, you can take a survey of GameStop, and there's a lot of crap on the shelves.
That's what I've noticed about the DS, is it seems that other than a handful of publishers, I mean, 99% of the stuff that came out for the DS was junk. And that was really not that different than the Famicom in Japan. I mean, in the U.S., we complain about all the crappy games like Friday the 13th and whatnot, but we missed out on a lot of the really bad stuff.
Yeah, true. I mean, when people complain about how Square Enix has gone off a cliff in terms of quality, because, I mean, look at all those great games that came out on PlayStation. None of them were bad. I like to, you know, show them the full extent of Square Enix's catalog and say, you know, they only brought... Well, that one actually came out... Oh, no, actually it didn't. No. Never mind. But no, I like to show them, you know, like, realize that the ones that were localized that you played were just the ones that they knew were good enough to sell over here. There were lots of them that they didn't publish. Some were good, some were bad. But yeah, I mean, there have always been lots of terrible games, and there always will be lots of terrible games. As long as there's money to be made, people will make cynical, low-quality games and hope to turn a profit on them. And that's just kind of the nature of things. But yeah, I mean, I certainly played my share of bad NES games, but there were a lot of really, really great ones too.
That point about the DS, like, I don't see as much trash on the 3DS as I saw on the DS and the Game Boy Advance and Game Boy Color. Have those developers just moved on to making, like, predatory iPhone games or something?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the iPhone sort of siphons off all the worst trash.
Yeah.
Pretty much. It's like, here, play a game.
Yeah, there's like 150 terrible new games a day.
Mm-hmm. Bold new era.
So anyway, that was 1983.
I was a whole year old.
Oh, a whole you were 1 year old.
I was 1 year.
Wow.
I was less than 1 year old.
So I didn't appreciate anything. I was just screaming, caring about my basic human needs.
Yeah.
All right.
Video games were not a concern.
Blankets, milk.
So you kids never saw Return of the Jedi when it first hit theaters then?
If I did, I didn't have any say in it, and I don't remember it. Yeah.
I'm old enough to have seen Empire Strikes Back in theaters.
Mm.
And actually, I saw Star Wars in the theatrical re-release where they added the new footage to it, which was around the time of Empire Strikes Back.
I saw Spaceballs when it first came out.
Is that when they added, like, the episode 4 onto the title scroll?
I think they did that, like, in 1978 or so. Okay. I'm thinking later they added, like, I'm positive they added some new footage, like a couple minutes of new footage or something. Honestly, I don't remember. I just remember seeing it in a drive-thru.
Okay, well, Bob and me will be over here.
All right.
Talk about Spaceballs.
Have fun.
That was our Star Wars.
So, yeah, I guess that about wraps it up for the first episode of Retronauts. We talked about 1983, and we talked about things that were much later than 1983. But it all came together in the end, by golly. So, Bob, I know you like to do the whatever.
Oh, man, I'm so prepared.
Okay.
I did want to ask, though, before we close up, what can modern console manufacturers learn anything from history, or is it just all just arbitrary? And
wasn't there an article about that on IGN? What console makers can learn from history?
I think it was what console makers can learn from Catherine.
Yeah.
But, I mean, can we say anything like that, like to make this somewhat, to give it some sort of... I don't know, common good cause.
Yeah.
Let Sony and Microsoft know and Nintendo.
They need to take more risks. And the Famicom was a huge risk for Nintendo.
Hmm.
And they were sort of pushing out into directions that people had not done before.
Nintendo could stand to use that lesson, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lately.
Yes.
They've been kind of
complacent.
Yeah. And when they do take risks, like when they kind of swallow their pride and say, yeah, we really overpriced the 3DS. Here, have a lot of free games and a price cut. Things go really well for them.
Right.
But when they just kind of, you know, when they are arrogant and say, well, we've done things this way, we can keep doing them this way, that's when they've always had failures. That's when they've always had problems, like with the N64 and the GameCube. And so... I think everyone could stand to take more risks. And I think developers should probably spend less money on their games so that they can afford to take more risks, so that they can make profits on a game that sells, oh, say 500,000 copies instead of 5 million.
Yeah.
And that was one of the amazing things about the early Famicom is when you play through those games, I mean, you will see new things on a regular basis. Right. I mean, just one week after the other, there'll be something you have not actually seen before.
I mean, I assume you're talking about doing the Crontendo style play chronologically.
Yeah. And so, I mean, back then, I mean, they didn't know what was going to sell. Mm-hmm. They tried a lot of things. A lot of things didn't work out, but they never stopped trying new things. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, that's something that, yeah, maybe indie game developers do that. Right. But certainly not the big companies.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't want to get too deep, but I feel like the most successful video games were disruptive in some way to what was in the market at the time. And I feel that developers think that they have genres figured out pretty much and there's nowhere to go. Right. So we're just going to like make these better and better, like within certain limitations. But I'm waiting for something to surprise me. Maybe I'm just old and jaded, but I haven't seen it happen.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think a big part of why Dark Souls and Demon Souls have been so popular is because they had a disruptive style. They they stood up to the increasing lack of tooth that, you know, modern action games have. And they didn't, they, you know, they didn't say, okay, it's all right if you lose. You can start over from the checkpoint here. I mean, they have penalties. They have genuine challenge. They expect you to learn their patterns. And, you know, those haven't sold on the level of Skyrim or something. But at the same time, they've really got a devoted fan base, and they really awakened a lot of people's hunger for games that do have that, you know, that sort of essential challenge to them that stand up to the player and say, you have to play well.
Right. And so there are modern examples, just not enough.
I mean, I think, you know, you made a joke about Catherine earlier, but I think that was kind of disruptive too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
It's such a strange game, and the themes of it are not what you expect from a puzzle game of all things. Yeah, I think there are a lot of really good, interesting games being made, mostly in the indie spaces these days. But, you know, people will still publish some pretty crazy stuff at retail. And you know, I hope people will go out and reward those games, you know, vote with your wallet instead of, you know, pirating it or whatever.
They won't. They'll buy Call of Duty 5.
Don't vote
with your
lizard
brain. Both. I think there's room. I mean, people are going to buy 11 million people are going to buy Call of Duty Ghosts. Okay, whatever. But those aren't the people who are really kind of the core gaming audience who buy something other than Call of Duty or buy something other than Madden. There's like people who buy their machines for those games.
Yes.
And then there are people who buy their machines to have a lot of great experiences. And I think more publishers could stand to kind of pull back on their budgets a little bit and make more games that are for that smaller audience that will appreciate their games more and be able to survive within kind of the ecosystem of that audience of, you know, however many million people it is. If it's 500,000 people, then so be it.
Yeah. Actually, some pretty big parallels between the game industry and the film industry nowadays, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Sort of, I mean, sort of stuck in the same mire in both cases.
Yeah, I mean, video games, Hideo Kojima and David Cage kind of epitomize this, but video games have a huge boner for Hollywood, and they want to be movies so badly that they're very often willing to just throw out everything that makes them unique as video games and just try to be, you know, a bad movie. And we have plenty of bad movies coming from Hollywood. We don't need more.
And ironically, a lot of movies nowadays look like video games, what with all the CGI cutscenes. Mm-hmm. Maybe they could just all switch places.
Maybe.
That's what they wanted in the 90s, right?
That's pretty much Rise, Son of Rome.
I'm thinking of things like, was it John Carter, the Mars one?
Yeah.
And also World War Z. I think they're blaming the audience, but it's like, no, you don't need to make something that expensive and awful. You could like have easily made a better movie.
Yep. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like a part of me really wants to hate Avengers from, you know, last year's movie.
Yeah.
But it was actually a fun movie. Like, I enjoyed it. The dialogue was punchy and the action scenes were well filmed. So even though it was ridiculously expensive, I mean, it definitely made back its budget. But I think it succeeded because it was so good. Like, it was actually a genuine, like, feel-good popcorn-type action flick. We saw it last year, and after we saw it, my wife looked at me and said, I want to see that again. So she went and she bought tickets, and we saw it immediately a second time, which was, you know, a little more than I necessarily wanted to see, but but it had that kind of effect. It was, you know, like, people who aren't really into action movies necessarily enjoyed it for the other qualities, and there aren't enough movies like that, you know? If people are going to invest a lot of money into a movie, they could at least invest some money into the script, maybe, which doesn't really happen a lot. That's kind of the last consideration. And
well, they do invest money into the script, only it's to hire 20 writers to rewrite
right,
it and
sure.
make these strange remnants of old movies in right. their script.
Right. So anyway, it's very easy to be cynical about all these things, movies and video games both, but I'm actually more cynical about movies because I feel like there is this rising indie surge in video games that, I don't know, like it's a good fallback point. When the big budget games stop to entertain, we always have people who are, you know, like four dudes making a video game that's really fun and interesting and unique.
Yeah.
Hollywood, I think, has problems. I'd rather watch something, you know, like a premium cable show like Mad Men or Game of Thrones or something than go and sit in a theater for 2 hours and be bored out of my mind by CG. Definitely.
And for all the promise left in video games, do we have July 1983 to thank?
To a degree.
Okay. I'll take it.
All right, so that wraps it up for this very first episode of Retronauts.
Would you like me to do the official business?
Yes, Bob.
I don't have it all written down, so this is not going to be a complete spiel.
I'm going to let you do that because I feel weird about asking for gifts and envelope art.
I want money.
They already gave us money, Bob.
Oh, right, I forgot.
That's the whole point. We don't need any more.
Okay. Well, I want some for me personally, but
yeah.
If you go to retronauts.com, that's our website. You know, subscribe to our Twitter account, twitter.com/retronauts, and we're facebook.com/retronauts. Just we're on everything.
We're on YouTube. YouTube. I don't think we've done anything with YouTube yet, but we will. Yet.
We will one day soon. And
Tumblr.
Also, Tumblr. Yeah, we're on Tumblr. And like we said in the beginning, this is not going to be on
Pinterest
iTunes immediately. What's up?
Pinterest
yeah. I guess. Grindr, whatever you want. maybe not
Vine.
Grindr.
No, I don't think we're on Vine.
Yeah, we're not on Vine. But like we said earlier, this is not going to be on iTunes immediately. Please don't complain. It will be there soon. And we just need time. So, but you can subscribe to it manually, like Ray said.
Yes.
Yeah.
Should we mention our Seattle adventure?
Yeah. Because that'll be, what, the weekend after this airs?
Yes.
So,
if you're in Seattle, July 13th?
Mm-hmm. 12th
weekend,
and 13th.
12th and 13th, yep. That weekend. We are at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo. We will have some sort of show there.
Yeah, I don't think we know what it's going to be yet, but it'll be awesome. Just you wait.
1984.
We'll be up there sweating and looking around nervously. I thought you had a topic.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
If that'll around, be that'll be the first of the three events we're obligated and committed to doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, indeed.
So anyway, from those of us here at Retronauts, we
one
thank
second.
You and we thank Dr. Sparkle.
We need to have Dr. Sparkle plug his
project.
Oh,
yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely.
Well, it's...
Now they put you on the spot.
Crontendo, you know, there's the YouTube channel, Crontendo, the blog spot, the Tumblr, the Twitter. Just Google Crontendo and you'll see it. And
that is Crontendo with an H because they were not restricted by Chrono Trigger character limits and could get the H in there.
Unless any Unix nerds are confused.
It's not Crontendo with a K because we're not in the 90s.
Yeah.
So.
And for any people out there who already are watching Crontendo, I'm sorry for taking so long on the episodes nowadays.
It's okay. They're always worth it.
Life happens.
Yeah. And now we're responsible.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have a lot of micro brews to drink. It's important.
Very true.
I agree.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed this first return episode.
Thank you.
We'll be back again in 2 weeks with a real episode and 1 week with a mini episode.
Yeah.